Checkerfin.
Fordham is always in my head.
Checkerfin. Checkerfin.
Yes.
It's the education gadfly
sex,
show.
Sex.
Mike and Rick tell you
early college, high school, pain and suffering,
in your face, in your face, in your face.
Listen to your word that they be preaching, cause here's the education gadfly show. Yeah, it's the education gadfly.
Hello, this is your host Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, here with my guest co-host, a woman who just had all of her Florida delegates stripped, Kate Walsh.
Hi, Mike.
How are you, Kate?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. Rick would be proud that we mentioned your name and the word stripped in the same sentence.
Oh, please. Is this going to be a running gag?
No.
I'm not going to come back and co-host anymore.
Well, Rick wanted me to tell you that that you're one fine-looking woman. He said that to me.
I've heard that before.
Yes. He's very insistent about this. And many of our female guest hosts are upset about this, but you've never complained.
No, I don't complain. Where's Rick this time?
Rick, I'm on vacation. Hess is in Aruba celebrating his 40th birthday. It's pretty nice, huh?
Yeah, for my 50th birthday, I spent it in Catonsville, Maryland.
Oh, very nice. How did that happen? John is not on the ball with that.
He promised me a trip to Nova Scotia, but it was snowing and cold there. I said, I don't really want to go to Nova Scotia right now. So that's in the works.
Let's get started, Kate. We've got a busy day here. We're going to, of course, play a game of Pardon the Gadfly. Then Kobe is going to give us a movie review of the documentary 2 Million Minutes. And then Liam will impart some education news of the weird. Sound good?
Sounds great. Let's go.
All right. Let's play Pardon the Gadfly. Christina is out sick, so Kobe, I'm sorry, Liam, you're up.
A disgruntled teacher writes in the LA Times this week that United Teachers Los Angeles is, quote, the union that LAUSD deserves, ineffective and one-dimensional. Kate, do you think lots of teachers share his frustration with the union? Will that frustration ever lead to meaningful change?
Oh, absolutely. A lot of teachers are not particularly pleased with their union, or they don't even pay attention to what their union is doing and are surprised when you bring it up. For example, this week, Mike Antonucci had a great story about where the NEA is spending its money. And I think a lot of teachers would be surprised if so much of their union dues goes out to support various organizations that the NEA likes.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the, can you think of any that are particularly
scandalous? Well, NK got $350,000. Center for Teaching Quality, run by Barnett Berry in North Carolina, got $275,000. And if you go to their websites, it's not really clear what that money was spent on. Mm-hmm. So it's not particularly transparent. I don't have any problems with the union's free to give money where it wants to give it. But what I object to is that they're not being open with their members about how they're spending their money.
Mm-hmm. And yet this problem about apathy among the teacher ranks when it comes to paying attention to what's going on with their union seems to be almost intractable. I mean, there's been some efforts to create alternatives to teachers' unions. They don't seem to be getting very far, especially in collective bargaining states. There's been some arguments that young teachers are especially open to reform ideas and may not be all that enamored with their unions. They certainly aren't getting a good deal, with their low pay and their, puny retirement benefits that they'll probably never get because they're never going to stick around 30 years.
Well, that's the first time I've ever heard anybody say retirement benefits for teachers are puny.
Well,
they're probably the most lucrative in the country.
I misspoke. That's right. But the younger teachers are unlikely to ever see those benefits because they'd have to stick around for 30 years. Let's go beyond the bell briefly. But my question is this, Kate. I mean, is there any hope for an alternative to the teachers' union getting going, or are we just pretty much stuck with unions for the foreseeable future?
Well, that depends on your view of unions. I happen to think unions do a pretty good job of what they're supposed to be doing. What the problem is that they're up against pretty ineffective leadership on the other side of the table. So unions are protecting their members, and they do a pretty good job of that. So who are we to complain? What we should be complaining about is the fact that school leadership, district and state leadership, doesn't do a particularly good job of negotiating back.
Okay. All right, Liam, next question.
The Chicago Public Schools announced an initiative this week to turn around a cluster of failing schools. which will include firing teachers and leaders, some aren't so sure it will do any good, can turnarounds succeed?
I do believe they can succeed, although we haven't had a great track record so far. The big question is this: are you going to change the system that surrounds these schools so that you don't just recreate the same problems you have now? If you fire everybody and replace them with a great staff, that's a good start. But if then you have the same ineffective HR processes, if you have the same ineffective leadership coming from the district, the same bureaucratic rules and regulations, you are likely to over time see those schools just evolve back into what they used to be as teachers get frustrated and leave and they have to get replaced by less qualified teachers. So you gotta think about this systematically. It appears that Chicago is trying to do that, at least by looking at a cluster of elementary and middle and high schools that are all feeder schools and trying to build some supports around that.
I'd agree. It's an elegant little experiment that Chicago's engaged in. And, you know, it's not that much different theoretically than a lot of other turnaround efforts, other than the fact that they want the children in a particular neighborhood to benefit from the age of four through graduation. So that makes it kind of a nice idea, sort of a good thing to try. But I have some doubts, as for the same reasons that you do, that they can pull it off unless they change the structure of those schools. But also, keep in mind what neighborhoods these kids are coming from, and you know it's not entirely the schools doing what happens to these kids. So there's a whole system of that bell is.
You can say it, Kate. I mean, you can just swear at that bell if you want.
But the school, you know, the structure in those schools is in large part a response to the overwhelming challenges of trying to educate children in those neighborhoods. And that doesn't get the schools off the hook. But you cannot pretend that those challenges aren't there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Next question, Liam.
In his State of the Union address, the president called on Congress to reauthorize No Child Left Behind. A coalition of left-leaning groups is holding an event today to warn about the costs of waiting to reauthorize the law. Is there any reason to believe that this ship will sail?
I think I've already noted for the record that No Child Left Behind is not a topic that anybody is going to touch in this election year.
It's interesting, though, Kate, you know, that you still hear people on the Hill saying that they're going to get this done. Rahm Emanuel the other day, who was the head of the Democratic caucus, said that this was one area where he could see some bipartisan work being done. Senator Kennedy is still talking about marking up a bill in the spring. I agree with you, though. I think they're going to run into the same problems that Chairman Miller ran into this past fall, which is once you get beyond the high-level platitudes, there's not a lot of agreement about what should be done to fix this law. And anything that's done that pleases the teachers' unions is going to get vetoed by President Bush.
I mean, it's disingenuous to say there's a spirit of bipartisanship surrounding No Child Left Behind, because as soon as you dig down one inch into the act, there's wild disagreement on what should happen. And my guess is that those of us who are pro-accountability will find ourselves wishing that nothing happens, mm-hmm. because if anything's going to happen, it will gut the one strength of No Child Left Behind, and that's its accountability.
Well, I agree and disagree at the same time. I mean, I think if you dig below the elite leaders in Washington, I think that's true. But I think if you simply put Ted Kennedy and George Miller and President Bush in a room together and said, okay, hammer out the next version of No Child Left Behind, I think they could do so and come up with a law that they'd all be happy with. The problem is they couldn't then sell it to their base. And in this election year, that's a killer. All righty. Well, that is all the time we have for Pardon the Gadfly. Kate, yeah, it looks a little upset at that bell.
No, I was just... No, it's the bell's fine. Thank you.
It's not the bell's fault.
No, we're a little
for
off
whom
today.
The bell tolls. Well, okay. Well, coming up next is a special feature. Those of you that have been listening know that we haven't been doing interviews every week. You know, partly, let's face it, because we have a new office and we haven't figured out how to make phone calls. Once we get that ironed out, we will go back to having some interviews.
I do have to congratulate you on your digs. They are just lovely.
Thank you.
As I come from my digs, where I look out on the tattoo parlor and the shutdown bakery and the homeless people sleeping all through the streets. It's a welcome respite to come over here to the Fordham Foundation.
Well, thank you. Well, we and others can come on by. We have an open house this coming Wednesday from 5 to 7, so hope people do swing by. Okay, but that said, we are going to add some new features this year, and one of those is an occasional movie review from our movie critic, Kobe Loop. So Kobe here with his review of the documentary 2 Million Minutes.
Global warming, the war in Iraq, America's diminishing competitive edge. It's hard to say which of these front page topics incites the strongest hyperbole among our cultural commentators. But the new documentary 2 Million Minutes tacks some serious points onto the diminishing competitive edge column. The film follows six students, two each from the US, China, and India, through their daily routines. Neil, from Carmel, Indiana, works 20 hours a week at Fazoli's and has secured a full-ride scholarship to Purdue University. By his own admission, he doesn't work very hard in school.
There's a chance that I'll actually have to start putting more effort into schoolwork. Because that's what people have always told me, because I've always kind of excelled without putting forth a lot of effort. Sorry, I know that when I get to college, I'm actually going to have to somewhat start studying for classes a lot more.
Neil plans to design video games for a living. Brittany, also from Carmel, plans to go pre-med. We see her with a group of girlfriends at a joint Grey's Anatomy watching study session.
Although I might not score a perfect on the SATs or in math and in science, I do think that I was brought up to be more well-rounded in a sense of socially, not taking anything away from the kids in China and India because they do work hard.
Meanwhile, Apoorva and Rohit from India and Zhou Yan and Ri Zhang from China spend most of their waking minutes studying and most of their on-camera time telling us about it. The contrast between the American and Asian students is compelling, but it's also manipulative. For one, it ignores far deeper contrasts between us and Asia, namely the stark social divides that will doubtless impede their supposed ascent to the global throne. And yes, their social divides are much, much wider than ours. It also ignores economic logic, building its fears of our impending doom on the fallacy that trade and innovation are zero-sum games. They're not. Japan's rise, for instance, did not mean our downfall. It simply meant we all got to enjoy exercising while listening to Walkmen. Finally, there's the caveat that China's 600,000 engineers won't successfully compete with our 60,000 if their creative urges are stifled by a regimented, test-taking culture that leaves little room for risk-taking and creativity. Not that we should be complacent, but, like global warming in Iraq, the question of American economic competitiveness is far too complex to be got at by such an uninformed, one-dimensional analysis. You can find out more about the documentary at 2mminutes.com.
Okay, so Kate, what do you think? Is this smart for education reformers to try to base our whole case on economics? That if we don't fix our schools, America is going to decline economically?
Well, I just think it's smart politically. If you don't make that argument, then how do you get anyone's attention? Certainly it was the, when in the era of Sputnik and, we were losing our competitive edge and the Russians were going to, out-educate, outspend, outdo us in every aspect. Mm-hmm. That was a great motivator in this country. And absent that kind of competitive threat, how do you persuade Americans that it's a good idea that we begin to educate our young?
I guess that's all fair, but I'm a little worried about crying wolf. I mean, we know that back in the 1980s, there was all this concern that Japan was going to take over the world and was going to cream us economically. That led to a lot of stuff, including a nation at risk. And that led to lots of good education reforms. But it's fair to say that we go back and we look and we say, wow, Japan wasn't quite the threat that we thought it was. And I wonder if we'll have that same experience with China and India, if we shouldn't be also at least talking about, the importance of preparing children for citizenship, for example, or keep that focus on the achievement gap and making our country strong, not just, hey, we need to compete with those Indian and Chinese engineers.
But why do you care? It's provided that we still address the achievement gap and provided that we do fund an effort that has, nothing gets people more geared up than a fight.
I guess that's true. The question is, will it work? Will it keep working? Or will people at some point saying, look, I feel like we've heard this argument before that America is going to fall apart if we don't fix our schools. We haven't fixed our schools and we still haven't fallen apart. But I guess time will tell.
Fair enough.
All right. Well, it is now that special time, the time we wait for all week long, education news of the weird time. With our special correspondent, Liam Julian. Liam, what's weird this week?
Heated education debates are taking place in the UK. In 2007, government guidelines in England suggested that unisex laboratories with blurred glass walls could help in the battle against school bullies. The government also says school toilets are recognized as being a trouble spot for bullying. According to reports, some children avoid going to the bathroom because they're afraid. Quote, "I don't want my head dunked down the toilet," unquote, said one pupil. Now in 2008, the issue is back, but this time the British government suggests clean bathrooms, not unisex ones, will put a stop to the bullying problem. It's unclear exactly how that would happen. A spokesman for the Department for Children, Schools, and Families said that it was clearly unacceptable that children might be put off using toilets for fear of bullying. Quote, "We've given schools record capital investment over the next 3 years, and they've now got clear design guidance so schools can build high-quality pupil toilets," unquote. And that's education news.
You laugh.
I know, absolutely.
You laugh, but
I know. I'm very serious. I
thought that was like a dead
guy. Got my head dunked in the toilet by Jeff Cooner, our communications director, today.
Yeah, in fact, and so Liam doesn't drink any water or coffee all day long so that he doesn't have to go to the bathroom.
I'm sorry.
But there are plenty of children who did not go to the bathroom all day when they're in school for exactly those reasons. One, the bathroom might be filthy. But two, they're afraid. I mean, this is not Great Britain. This is a good proportion of schools in the United States that are serving poor kids. Kids refuse to go into the bathroom.
Okay, so I understand that, and that is no laughing matter. But here is the question, Kate. How is cleaning the bathrooms going to help to prevent bullying in the bathrooms? I mean, what, do bullies not like clean bathrooms? I mean, it's that logic that we're struggling with here.
Well, the idea is it's the same idea as one might put children in uniforms, make sure that they look respectable so that they don't look like they're about to engage in a fight. So a child goes into a bathroom.
The broken stalls theory.
The broken toilets theory, yes.
Well, it's absolutely true. If you have graffiti all over, you know, a little bit of graffiti invites a lot of graffiti. A little bit of cleanliness invites respect and calm and no anger.
So what does this mean about your office that you just a moment ago explained looks out on all kinds of graffiti and decrepit urban decay?
We don't look out the window. We have actually a very luxurious bathroom. That's the one plus of our building.
And that is probably good for your productivity.
Oh, please.
What?
Just sounded a little, the analogy was something. It took me places I didn't want to go.
Well, thank you, Liam. I've noticed lately that we really have to go overseas for education news of the weird. Does that mean there's just nothing weird happening in here in the good old US of A?
It's an election season, so maybe that's keeping, you know, the weird news out of the papers.
Ah, I see. So weirdness is happening, it's just not being reported.
Yeah, maybe I'll have to get out there.
Maybe it's a cover-up.
Yeah.
Yeah, we might need to do that. You know, hit the pavement a little bit. And then while you're out, you could use the restroom someplace else. Okay, Kate. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. You know, I just realized that I never properly introduced you. I assume that all of our listeners know who the legendary Kate Walsh is.
I think all of your listeners probably do know.
Okay, but it's not I think you do. It is not the star of Grey's Anatomy. And now, what's the other show that?
It's Grey's Anatomy.
Yeah.
And now she has her own show, but I don't know what it is.
Yeah, because we just don't watch television. Is that why? See, if Rick were here, he would know because he's Mr. Pop Culture. We'll have to ask him next week. But No, this is Kate Walsh, the head of the National Council on Teacher Quality, nctq.org, which does great work on the teacher quality front, even though they look out onto urban decay.
So. That keeps us inspired.
All right. Well, thank you, Kate, for joining us. Until next week, who are you, Kate?
I'm Kate Walsh.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, signing off.